We found that was a somebody recorded it off vinyl, so it doesn't sound that great, but one of my favorite albums of all time, Levon Helm and the RCO All-Stars, released late 70s after the band did The Last Waltz. It was Levon's first solo album, but really not a solo album, the RCO All-Stars, the band, short-lived, but what a band. The guys, the horn section from the Blues Brothers, prior to the Blues Brothers, Alan Rubin, Tom Malone, Lou Marini, Howard Johnson, the great Paul Butterfield, the wonderful guitarist Fred Carter Jr., Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn and Booker T. Jones from Booker T. and the MGs, Dr. John, all these people on this album. It's a great album. Anyway, Glenn Garvin, our first guest, our friend from the Miami Herald, requested that as a walk-up song. He requested the Chuck Berry original. Chuck wrote it, but I just love that version, even though it was recorded from vinyl onto a little tape recorder or something. I don't know. It's hard to find anymore on the internet, the actual album. But anyway, here he is, Glenn Garvin, Miami Herald. Hi, Glenn. How you doing?
Pretty good. We should just note for the record that the Chuck Berry version of that song is thought to be one of the inspirations for Louie Louie. Play it again sometime and listen to see if you see the similarities.
Yes, that is true. And Mike's going to cue it up. So anyway, thanks for joining us, as always.
Great to be here. And I got to hear a new version of Havana Moon.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Okay, I'm a little confused. Now, you were the TV guy for a long time for the Herald, and you've talked to us about TV before, but
I can still talk about TV. I still write about TV for Reason Magazine.
Oh, okay,
but,
cool.
You know, I also was a foreign correspondent for a long time, wrote a couple of books about Latin America.
That's right.
And back in my, that's a little clue about how old my obituary of Fidel Castro that ran in the Miami Herald on Sunday really is. I wrote that back when I was still working on the foreign desk in 2001.
So, yeah, everyone was writing the Fidel obits a long time ago because nobody could believe he was still going to be alive, but he finally died at 90. But so did they ran your 2001 obit?
Well, that's when the main thing was written. Of course, we've touched it up a little each year,
right.
Especially in 2008 when he resigned the Cuban presidency after he became pretty ill. So I don't want to suggest that obit is a snapshot of 2001.
But no, exactly.
That's when it goes back to.
Okay, yeah. I mean, you know, there's some of it from the 2001, but obviously updated. But
right. I thought, frankly, you know, newspapers aren't doing so good these days. I don't know if you've heard. And there have been times when I wondered if Fidel Castro would outlive the Miami Herald, but it didn't work out that way.
You wrote, "Few fired the hearts of the world's restless youth as Castro did when he was young." Talk about that a bit.
Well, remember that the late 1950s, when Fidel Castro emerged from the mountains of Cuba as a guerrilla commander and took over the country, is a little bit of a precursor to the politics of the 1960s, and there was a sense among a lot of people, including. Frankly, the CIA station in Havana, that this was the Fidel Castro was nothing more sinister than the face of youth, the changing of the guard, a new generation asserting itself.
Yeah.
And those things may have been true, but of course he was also much more, including, as he denied at the time, a communist.
And for those of you you youngsters out there, if you want to learn more about Castro and what happened in Cuba before Castro and before, just watch Godfather Part Two. It's all there. Talk a little bit about pre-Castro Cuba. It was Havana was pretty much run by the mafia, and it was all gambling and hotels and very fancy.
Well, I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration. An awful lot of people agree with you about that. And the mob was there, and there were casinos and extensive prostitution, and it was definitely a place for American high rollers to go.
Right.
Not all of them necessarily sleazy-minded. It was kind of the playground for the wealthy of the American East Coast. And the mob was definitely very present and powerful. I think the real problem, though, with Batista, the Cuban dictator of the time, right, was that he had been president in the 30s, had been a liberal reformer, and had been immensely popular. So when he came back in the 50s, people said, "Hey, this is pretty good. He'll get things straightened out like he did 20 years ago." For a while, people were okay with him, but then he decided he really liked power a lot more than was healthy for him or Cuba. There was a lot of corruption, and Castro was able to surprisingly easily boot him out of office. I mean, this was a guy who had access to tons of weapons from the United States. He was paying for them, not getting them free, but he was not unarmed or defenseless. And this group of people who were really not much older than college kids came out of the mountains and defeated him, ran him out of Cuba.
Right. In fact, they officially hit Havana on New Year's Eve.
Yes, that's right. Batista flew to Miami, and Castro's forces were there on New Year's Eve. He came in a couple of days later on a big parade.
Right.
Zillions of Cubans in the street cheering him, waving at him. Abby Hoffman was among them. I don't know exactly why he was there, but he wrote a description of Fidel that I believe we are not allowed to recite on the radio, even in this liberated time. But Google Abby Hoffman and Fidel Castro, and you'll see what I mean.
Mike's doing it right now. You got Havana Moon? Let's do Chuck Berry. He wrote the song. All right, check this out.
Havana Moon, Havana Moon, me all alone with jug of rum, me stand and wait for boat to come. It's long the night, it's quiet the dock, the boat she late since 12 o'clock. Me watch the tide easing in, it's loading moon, but hide the wind. Havana moon, Havana moon, me all alone, me open the rum, it's long the wait for boat to come. American girl, come back to me, we'll sail away across the sea. We'll dock in New York, the buildings high, we find a home up in the sky. Havana moon, Havana moon.
Yeah, I love that. A lot of people say that Louie Louie got its inspiration from that. Richard Berry wrote Louie Louie, but he wrote that in, 1955, okay. But the big hit for Louie Louie was 1963.
The Kingsmen.
The Kingsmen, a Washington State band. And it had and I remember this as a kid listening to it, supposedly there was an F-bomb in there, but nobody's been able to prove that.
Everybody said it was full of filthy lyrics. Yeah. I remember seeing some of the supposed lyrics. I think that was... did you ever hear that a golf ball would explode if you cut it open? I think this was from the same genre of youthful misinformation.
Exactly. It's like Paul is dead. There's an F-bomb in Louie Louie by the Kingsmen. See if you can find the Richard Berry original version of Louie Louie, Mike, and we'll play that. That's anyway. Well, we're getting off on sidebars here today. We're talking with Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald about Cuba and Castro and such. Where were we? I forget.
I think Castro had just come down from the mountains and taken over Cuba. So we've got another 50 years of history to go through here.
All right, so he takes over, and then he throws out, there's no more casinos or gambling or big hotels, and then it starts going downhill for a lot of people at that point.
Right. He certainly was rough on American interests in Cuba. He confiscated a lot of things, oil companies and sugar plantations and homes of just plain Americans who lived there. But he was also cracking down on the Cuban population. Very soon, a lot of the men who had served with him in the mountains turned against him. And there was a rival force when Castro was victorious. There was another force of rebels, and they wanted to keep their weapons. And Castro said, armas para qué, in Spanish, arms, what for, became a popular bumper sticker in Cuba. So they were kind of shamed into it. They laid down their arms, and, of course, they were all promptly arrested and imprisoned. There's a kind of left-wing mythology in this country that the United States pushed Castro into the arms of communism. But with modern scholarship, we know that's absolutely not true. A lot of documents from the Soviet Union of those days have been released. Raul and Fidel have been increasingly candid in their recollections of what was going on. And he was a communist from the first. He wisely concealed that fact.
Marxist.
But within a year or two, he was, of course, inviting the Soviet Union to put nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba.
Right. And apparently, there has never been a dictator or leader in the world who was targeted as many times for assassination as Castro.
Gosh, the CIA sure went after him.
They had the cigar that they were thinking he would smoke and it would blow his head off. They had something.
Right.
I read something yesterday about a milkshake that they gave him that was hopefully going to kill him, or that was one of their plans.
I think that's true. There was an exploding seashell. They had something. There was a wetsuit, a scuba diving suit that was going to have to be implanted with some drug that would make his beard fall out, because the CIA psychological warfare guys thought Cubans would say, oh my God, his beard fell out, let's get rid of him. You see, the Saddam Hussein's WMDs were not maybe the first problem with the CIA.
Yeah. And of course, during the Kennedy administration, Khrushchev and Castro were the bane of JFK's existence in many ways.
That's right. The missile crisis was absolutely the point that the world came closest to nuclear war in 1962. The Bay of Pigs. There was the Kennedy and the CIA backed a Cuban exile army that invaded Cuba and got pinned down on the beachhead and clobbered.
And they were supposed hopefully going to overthrow the Castro regime.
Right, that was the idea. On the assassination attempts, one of the great ironies, I think, in my lifetime, is that on the day, at the precise hour that President Kennedy was being assassinated in Dallas, the CIA station chief in Paris, in France, was meeting with a disgruntled member of the Cuban government, giving him literally a poison pen, a fountain pen with a retractable needle in it,
right,
with which he could kill Castro. And in the middle of the lunch, the CIA man is called away from the table. He comes back somewhat shaken and says, President Kennedy has just been killed in Dallas. We're going to have to postpone this discussion. And it never restarted.
Amazing story. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the Cuba thing and Castro and the Kennedys. Pretty amazing. There are also people, conspiracy theorists, who think that maybe the CIA and some Cubans were a part of the Kennedy assassination, along with the mob.
The that the theory to which you're referring is sort of right-wing Cubans who were angry that Kennedy did not give the air support he had promised to the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Right.
The theory that has come to light a lot more in recent times is that Lee Harvey Oswald, this part is not a theory, this is a known, verified fact. Lee Harvey Oswald, 6 weeks before the assassination, was in Mexico City. He went to the Soviet Union and tried to get a visa to Moscow. And when that didn't work, he went to the Cuban embassy and tried to get a visa to Havana. Neither country would grant him a visa. And there were some very angry words exchanged in the Cuban embassy between Oswald and the Cubans. The one theory is that the Cubans said, "Nah, you know, why should we let you in? We don't need some vagrant American hanging around. What have you ever done for the revolution?" To which Oswald shouts, "I'll show you what I can do for the revolution."
Yeah.
That is unverified and unverifiable, I suppose, but it's an interesting theory as well.
But we do know that he was in at least New Orleans handing out leaflets before the assassination for the Fair Play for Cuba committee or something.
That's right. And got in a tussle with some Cuban exiles, a little shoving match on the street. Got into the newspapers there. One of the theories is that he deliberately did this in public and was provocative about it because he wanted to have some news clippings to show the Cubans, hey, look, I'm a Castro loyalist.
Right.
You should give me a visa.
Wow. And, of course, you can see watch JFK, Godfather Part II, many other movies to learn it. But you're welcome for this free history lesson here brought to you by KSRO on The Drive and Glenn Garvin from the Miami Herald. One thing, we had a Cuban professor, a professor of Cuban studies yesterday from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. One of the things I brought up to him and asked him, because we see people in Cuba actually mourning, they've got a 9-day mourning period and all this, and they're standing in line to pay respects. In Miami, however, the exiles are cheering and partying. Explain that a little more, if you can.
Well, Castro, Castro is an extremely, regardless of what you think of his politics, he's been an extremely divisive character in the history of Cuba. People say Donald Trump is divisive. This is a guy Castro is a guy who drove something on the order of 25% of the population off the island. People fled in all directions, and because it's only 150 or so miles away, Miami was one of the principal places they landed. Miami is now really the northernmost point of Latin America. Instead of the southernmost point of North America.
Wow.
Most of the politicians and the power structure in Miami are Cuban Americans. People, the original immigrants who came here are now too old and have loosened their grip on things. But their children and grandchildren very much run this city, and these are people who hate Castro. They were driven out, and in some cases their relatives were imprisoned or even executed. Their homes were confiscated. They left, in most cases, with nothing but the shirts on their back. These kind of things aren't forgiven or forgotten, not easily. And I was talking to somebody on CNN Friday night, and they said, "Well, so there's a lot of mixed emotions in Miami, right?" And I said, "What? Not at all.
Not there.
Not at all." There are undoubtedly Cubans on the island who still supported Fidel, but in Miami there are none, I assure you.
Let me just quote part of Glenn's article here in the Miami Herald, miamiherald.com. The Cuban Missile Crisis was neither Castro's first nor last confrontation with the United States, though it was certainly the most epic. No other individual has ever tormented Washington more or longer. Now, this I did not know. At age 12, Castro wrote to FDR congratulating him on his third inauguration as president and asked him for a dollar. By the time he was 35, two American presidents had devoted a considerable amount of time and effort to killing Castro. So, I mean, that was one hell of a weird life, that guy.
he's, you know, the obituary I wrote for the Miami Herald was, 270 column inches, which comes out to, 7,000-8,000 words. It's an insane length for a newspaper story, but this man was completely central to all the politics, all the foreign politics of the second half of the 20th century.
Yeah.
We've gone through just a little bit of it: the Bay of Pigs, the missile crisis. There was the Mariel flotilla to the United States. 120,000 Cubans come in.
Yeah.
Probably that cost Jimmy Carter the 1980 presidential election.
Yeah, and that was 1980. And then don't forget Elian Gonzalez, who I saw being interviewed today. He was six when they got him and took him back to Cuba. And he's been loyal to the regime. And I guess now he and his family are very wealthy over there, and he's very happy.
Interesting. And the Elian Gonzalez situation, probably, remember, Al Gore lost the state of Florida by, 300, 400 votes? The whole presidential election turned on that. I am sure that there were 400 Cuban Democrats in Miami who said, wait, you're sending Elian Gonzalez back to the island? We're not voting for we're not voting for a Democrat again anytime soon. So this guy conceivably changed the results of two U.S. presidential elections. The ethnic and sociological complexion of Florida completely altered by the influx of Cubans touched off by Castro. Yeah. You just can't count the ways this guy had a major impact on the United States. And then you go to the rest of Latin America and the revolutions in El Salvador and Nicaragua and every place else. And he was, as my dad would have said when he was trying to avoid political fights, he would say, he was something.
On that note, he was something. Glenn Garvin, our friend from the Miami Herald, thank you so much for taking the time. Let's talk again soon, man.
And when you guys need a music director there, I'm happy to volunteer.
All right, cool. And
good talking to you guys.
You're also one of our TV guys too, so we'll talk soon. Thanks, Glenn.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay. All right, here's the original Louie Louie without any F-bombs. Richard Berry wrote it in 55.
Fine little girl, she wait for me. Me catch the ship across the sea. I sail the ship all alone. I never think I'll make it home. Louie Louie, well, me got it.
Sonoma County, I'm Steve Kerr, and this is the home of Golden State Warriors play-by-play, 1350 and FM 103.5 KSRO.